This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name's Sophie Black, and welcome to this new news session on branded content. Before we get going, I'd just like to acknowledge that we're meeting today on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present and to the elders of all other communities. And now to our esteemed guests. Okay, I'll start with Tim down the end. Tim Duggan is the publisher and co-founder of Junkie Media, reaching over 5.5 million people each week with titles that include Junkie, In the Mix, Faster Louder, and the travel title AWOL. Ricardo Belli founded global journalism agency Newsmodo in 2012. The platform and Australian-based team provide an end-to-end publishing solution leveraging a network of 25,000 freelance journalists and content creators around the world. Alan Williams was appointed Managing Director, Australian Publishing Media in April 2013, prior to joining Fairfax Media New Zealand as CEO in 2009. He led a number of the company's operations across rural, regional and metropolitan markets in Australia and the US. He returned to the company in 2007 following the Rural Press Limited merger with Fairfax Media. And Alan currently represents Fairfax Media as Director of Australian Associated Press. Ian McClelland is Managing Director of Guardian Australia and is responsible for all commercial and operational aspects of the Guardian's Australian business. Ian's previous position was advising Fremantle Media Australia's regional CEOs with their digital strategy and business development. Thanks for joining us, gentlemen.
Pleasure. So, welcome.
And unfortunately, Emily Bell, who was originally scheduled to be on this panel as well, had to cancel due to sickness, but I'm not sure we could have fitted her on stage. So that may be for the best.
More room for
yeah,
us.
I think so. Now, look, before we start, let's just get our definitions straight, because there is a lot of confusion around this kind of content and what it actually is and what these different definitions mean, even amongst, as we were just discussing, amongst the newsroom and amongst each other. Like, everybody seems to have different definitions. So what is the difference, very, very simply and basically, between branded content and native advertising? Rakhal, do you want to have a stab at that?
Sure. So thank you very much. At Newsmodo, we are essentially a supplier to a lot of publishers and brands. So we create content that is of an editorial nature, typically crafted by journalists for brands and also in the native advertising space. To me, and looking at this from a content marketing lens, I see branded content typically as content that is produced and published by brands and is published on property that the brands actually own. For instance, a blog, a content hub, ANZ Blue Notes being a great example of a great publication that is 100% owned by the brand. Native advertising, to me, in my interpretation, is typically of an editorial nature. We know what quote-unquote native is, but it, in my interpretation, is generally placed on a third party's platform or property in the expectation of reaching a new audience to drive traffic to your brand.
Would you agree with that, Tim?
There's almost as many definitions as examples of kind of what content, of what native advertising is, what sponsored content is, what advertorial is. In my mind, it's all kind of smooshed. I don't know if that's an official word, but it's the same. It's all smooshed
we'll make
together
it so.
In the same kind of area. So we kind of have a simple-ish definition that we use in native advertising, and it has kind of three parts, and then there's a fourth part which is has kind of been added into it. The first part that we're going to say is quality content, and that's kind of what separates it a little bit from advertorial and things like that in the past, because generally the way we approach it is it's made by the same content teams, and we'll probably have some discussion over that. Inspired by the brand, which kind of means that you generally take, you know, a brief of what the brand's trying to get across, and you kind of come up with ideas in a kind of creative process that's similar to I used to work in advertising agencies, kind of how you kind of come up with ideas like that. And then delivered in stream means that it looks like and feels like every other piece of content. The fourth one is kind of clearly signposted. And that to me is, in our definition at Junkie Media, when we say native advertising or native content, it's kind of got to fit all four of those things. If it doesn't, then it's not real native advertising, according to us.
I want to get a sense from each of you about the resources involved and how important a role branded content plays within each organisation. Obviously, we've got representatives from, you know, traditional mastheads like The Guardian and the Fairfax titles, and then we've got Newsmodo and Junkie who are newer players. So, Tim, I'll start with you and we'll work our way across. Do you, you mentioned there that a lot of that content is created by your journalists, so you don't have a dedicated department that is just devoted to creating branded content? How does it work?
We do actually. We've got both. We've got a dedicated department that's devoted to almost managing the process more than that. Right. So we call it Junkie Studio. And Junkie Studio for us is kind of all the work we do with brands. So they, because it is very much a process, like it's kind of like it's briefs and it's kind of responding to things and coming up with ideas and kind of balancing that line between what the brand wants and what the publisher wants. So within that process, we've got about 35 to 40 staff across Junkie Media. About 15 of them are kind of in the editorial-y space. Mm-hmm. And the Junkie Studio team is probably about 5 to 7, I would say. And that includes some video journalists, includes producers, it includes kind of native editors. But we do try and get the whole wider team involved in creating the content, because then you've kind of almost got one tone. And I must point out that when we say the content, we are entertainment. So Junkie is kind of pop culture from politics to news. Yeah. We have travel titles. We've got music titles. So we are not hard-hitting news. So our journalists, I don't even really use the term journalists for ours. They're kind of content creators. They're writers. They're editors. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of a little bit different from a traditional news organisation.
I've got lots of questions from that, but we'll keep going. We'll go to each of you first and then we'll come back. Raquel?
So I guess it's important for me to note that when we launched Newsmodo, we actually were taking a platform to market that connected a growing network of freelance journalists, who most of whom had been made recently redundant globally, with a diminishing publishing capability at the buyer's end, essentially, of traditional newsrooms. And our client base consisted exclusively of newspapers, magazines, TV newsrooms. And it's only been in the last year or so that we've really fallen into the branded content space. And now the large majority of the content that we create is still crafted by journalists in the same fashion that we would have briefed them to create editorial content, traditional editorial content. But now, of course, it's delivered to publishers who then place that content as native advertising. And the majority of it is directly working with brands in helping empower them to become publishers themselves and build their audiences. So we actually, you know, in the mechanics of our business, we have an office in Melbourne and Sydney and a relatively small full-time team, under 15 staff. And our real power is the network of journalists who sit behind that platform. So we can draw on those journalists depending, a little bit different to Tim's, structure. We would work particularly exclusively with journalists depending on their area of expertise and particularly with which clients require what kind of skill sets.
Okay. Alan, how does it work at Fairfax?
Well, it's an interesting model for Fairfax, because let's put Fairfax into the traditional media company model. And what I want to say, let's sort of separate a few things for Fairfax. Domain is a brand in its own right. Domain has native advertising in it and branded content. It's removed from the newsroom. So there are elements of our model which are further away from that core newsroom, which represents a lot of the values around what we believe we stand for in the major masthead brands like The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald, or even as I was talking about in the last session about the Newcastle Herald and Joanne McCarthy and the great work she's done. So we've got to sort of peel back some of the layers within Fairfax to have a look at where this sort of sits in the organisation and then say, well, where do we sit today? And, you know, we've got a very small team of people that are working on this area. However, again, I've seen media companies and, you know, there's a couple of others here in Australia that are actually just buying agencies and embedding them in the core business, which presents a whole lot of dynamic issues for media companies, to the point then where you outsource a lot of this and you actually have to think about, do we just control the platform? These guys probably supply content to us in one way or form through a client. And then the issue comes, the value proposition around where it wants. We've got big audiences. We've got a lot of eyeballs. We've got people that associate with our brands for very different reasons to advertising, because of the social value, the community value. And then this issue is becoming for media companies, well, how do you blend that when you present it in the different platforms you've got? You know, media companies today, just on average, about 11% of the revenue, and I'm being across the board here, 11% of the revenue is in this space at the moment. It's not going to be the revenue that wins the race for us in terms of how we function in the future. It's one element of it. So there's different challenges within our organisation, and you've got to peel it back.
Yeah. So The Guardian's independence and our readers' trust in The Guardian is absolutely sacrosanct. Yeah. So it's within our charter. It's part of the Scott Trust charter. And so we divide completely and absolutely our branded content business, which is GLabs, and our editorial function. And we have about 20 GLabs staff in Australia, split between Sydney, Melbourne, about 80 in London, about 30 in New York. And they have networks of specialist illustrators, animators, designers, writers, videographers, etc., whatever we need to use on a case-by-case basis, connected to them. And they manage that, and they produce output, they produce content for brands. And then we have a clear distinction between content that is created by those teams, which we call paid for. So it's paid for. So we're clearly saying to our readers, this content is paid for by a brand. It's not Guardian editorial content, or it's editorial content. And we can have supported by editorial content where a brand sponsors or funds or helps to fund, but that's 100% editorial. The brand has no say in that content. There's no, and it's something that editorial want to do anyway. So that's how we delineate.
You mentioned that supported by. There's a whole heap of different ways of saying these things or labelling these things. Sponsored by, supported
schmoosh.
By.
I like schmoosh.
Powered by.
Schmoosh. Together. Schmoosh is nice.
Yeah. Schmooshed so by. All smooshed together. I like powered by.
We should give that to the IAB. Inspired by.
Inspired by is nice as well. Is there any distinction within the reader's mind over what that means?
Well, it's interesting. So we started, I guess newspapers have always done, as we were talking before, advertorial or advertorial features.
Yeah.
And I think that as it's become increasingly popular as a sort of response to there being an abundance of advertising and advertisers want to get cut through and they want to get engagement as readers are cutting off from standard advertising and blocking out either sort of psychologically or technically with ad blockers, a whole host of different ways in which a brand can influence content have emerged, and a whole range of different labeling approaches have emerged, and those differ, and there's a ranges between different media companies but also inside organizations as well. And when I joined The Guardian to launch Guardian Australia about 3.5 years ago, there was probably about 5 or 6 different labels associated brought to you by, sponsored by, in association with. I mean, just there was a whole host, and there was very complex rules describing different levels of influence that a brand may have. And I genuinely think The Guardian, we had lost our way and I think lots of media companies in an attempt to fight for what is a very, very competitive advertising market had been just developing these new ways in which we could give brands more control and influence. And it's just, it was difficult enough internally to decipher what the rules were. And is this associated with or is this sponsored by? We had having these debates, and we kind of thought, this is crazy. If it's crazy for us, what must the readers think? And they did, because Guardian readers tend to tell us exactly what they think quite often. And so they said that they're totally confused, and we surveyed our readers, and they're completely confused, and they had no idea what these different things meant. So we went through a consultancy, 18-month editorial commercial consultancy. We put it to our readers, and we basically came up with this. It's either supported by 100% editorially controlled, or it's paid for by 100, you know, and it's not editorially controlled. So it's really black and white now.
Yeah.
And we're really happy with that. Editorial are happy with that. Our clients are happy with that, and the readers are happy with that.
I think at the end of the day, it doesn't actually matter what it says, as long as there's something there that says to signify to the audience, as Ian said, that trust between any publisher and their audience is sacrosanct. That's the most important thing. So as long as the audience is not fooled in any way, the audience kind of doesn't... what I kind of hate is people that hide it. So you kind of get to the very bottom of a story and it's like, you read this really interesting story and it's like, why is publication X writing about this? In the very bottom, it's like, this was paid for by McDonald's.
Yeah.
Like that, to me, is bad native advertising practice.
And one thing we spoke about just before that I think is really important is if this is a really great piece and of a high quality in an editorial format, then the brand should be proud of the fact that they're sponsoring that and actually be pushing for their brand to be aligned with that piece of content, because there's some really great editorial style content that the brands are sponsoring out there that they should want to be aligned with, in my opinion.
So what is in it for the advertisers? What is appealing about this kind of content? And Alan, I'd be interested to know, as a newspaper man from way back, at what point do you stop flinching when you use the word content?
Yes, the comment was made, I'm the dinosaur in the group. I used to work on the North Shore Times and here in Sydney, and my job was I'd take the layout into the editor and put it on his desk and he'd say, get out, you know, you're a sales guy, get out, don't be involved. Look, I think one of the issues that is really telling in a traditional media organisation is this value proposition around is it genuinely good content?
Mm.
Now, you guys can debate, these guys can debate it because they come from a different platform and a different era, but in our organisation, this debate constantly goes on because the editorial teams, they're the protectors in some respects of that brand, that integrity, that knowledge, and also how we present issues to the community. And, you know, one of the real questions that is constantly asked is, well, this is a great article and it's a terrific article about such and such an advertiser, but is it of value to our audience?
Mm.
Now, the answer to that question is yes, if the audiences accept the fact that it's labelled correctly, they know it's an ad or they know it's something that's been branded that way. IMMA, the International Newspaper Marketing Association, and believe it or not, there is an organisation called the Native Advertising Institute, have been surveying traditional media companies. There's still something like 7% of traditional media companies that don't label this type of content.
Mm.
So why are they trying to fool the reader? That's really an interesting scenario. Is that the debate? I think one of the issues we spoke about before was I'm constantly challenging people in our organisation to say, well, when you're going and selling this or you're offering it to people, what are you actually promising? Because that's where a lot of the conflict comes into play.
I mean, I think that the emergence of the native advertising industry as a proper industry is actually a good thing, because everyone's aware that brands are now funding and creating their own content and publishing and distributing their own content. And I think whereas before, for the history of news media, you've had undue commercial influence on editors and on papers just because of the usual commercial structure of a news organisation. The editor reports to the CEO, the CEO reports to the board reports to the shareholders. And if the editor makes enough decisions about, you know, writing embarrassing revelations about clients, they'll lose their job. And that's been the history of news organisations. I mean, The Guardian's fortunate enough that we don't have that structure. So on the commercial side, we have absolutely no control over what the editors write, or more importantly, what they don't write. They report directly into the Scott Trust and can't be gotten rid of. So I think that there's actually been this hidden influence by both commercial and political on newspapers and a pressure about writing about certain subjects in a certain way or not writing about things. And I think that now it's becoming more of an expectation that you have to declare the influence. And I think that's a good thing.
I agree. I think that the challenge we're all seeing is that in the world of programmatic advertising, where it's been automated and traded and everything else, this stuff can pop up. You know, ads pop up, but content can pop up as well because of the way they present and format it. And it's presenting us with challenges in that regard, because there may be stuff that we don't want appearing on our sites, you know, competitors putting stuff up and doing. So there's a technology going on in the background here that's challenging us. And you know, it's easier when you have when you're new in the space because you haven't got a lot of the legacy values or the legacy of the structures of the newsrooms. I agree. There's separation of church and state in what we have to do. We don't tell people what to put into our papers, but it's the same. The same thing is, you know, we also have a feeling that we know what our audience wants. Mm. And is this the right thing to present?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, don't forget in this whole native advertising digital world who the ultimate decider is, and it is the audience. Mm. So you can create crap content and no one's going to read it and the client's not going to come back and they're not going to pay for it. You can create good content and everyone's kind of going to win. So the I think, you know, brands can do what they want, publishers can do what they want, but at the end of the day, if the audience is not reading, if they don't find value in it ultimately, there's no way you can get around that.
I was just going to add that I think there's an important note and a side conversation to all of this, and I know the focus in this dialogue is centred around native advertising on traditional publishers' sites, but there is a whole other industry that's really taking off, of course, in content marketing, which is where we centralise from our supplier perspective, where we deliver the vast majority of our content directly to the brands who are then publishing that content and becoming publishers themselves. Mm. Now, of course, they'll still place advertorials, native advertising content, on a third party's website or platform. Mm. However, the risk, dare I say, to some of the traditional publishers is at the same time, these guys are growing and growing and growing their own audiences, and eventually they may not need to place sponsored content on a third-party site to draw an audience because their audience, guess what, might be equally or if not bigger than what we determine to be.
I think that's a really interesting point. We've had a couple of brands that we work with who have got greater reach than we have, and that becomes a really interesting proposition, right? And some of them have got more data on that audience than we have, and so what we provide to them is taking all the techniques and technology and the storytelling and the know-how that G Labs has learnt from the editorial teams, this really high quality storytelling, and we produce content for the brand's own platform.
Right.
And that's great for us because we're utilising all this value in our organisation, and then there's no confusion with the audience because the content isn't even on our site; it's on the brand site. So that's a kind of perfect scenario for us, really. And then sometimes the brands will produce their own content, utilising Newsmodo or other agencies or creative, and then we've got a new format called Hosted By, and so we will host that content for them on The Guardian, and again it's labelled Hosted By and it says it's advertiser content, so it's just a new form of advertising.
So does this suggest that, I don't know, for Ian and Alan, your challenge is to retain the trust and build on the trust that you already have. For newer outlets, it's about building the trust. But Tim, from what you say, does good content trump trust these days? If brands' audiences are outstripping mastheads, do people not care about that stuff
anymore? That is a great question, and in particular even more relevant given things like instant articles. Mm. And, you know, where your Facebook instant articles where you stay on Facebook and kind of do not even go to someone's site, and Apple News and things like that, which are kind of taking them away from the platform that you're on and into the off-platform world where the audience lives. My view on that is that because content is now so easy to produce, anyone can do it, any brand can do it. Look at the things that go viral on Facebook and stuff like that. They're becoming kind of from anyone and everywhere. I actually think that the trust in a brand is even more important in that world.
Okay.
Because when someone sees a piece of content and they see New York Times or they see Guardian or they see Junkie, that is an instant indicator in, okay, there's kind of a bit of a quality check here, I know what they stand for, I like them or I don't like them, you can make that decision. Whereas if they get something that comes from Viral USA or Viral Buzz or any of kind of like, you know, mutations on that, which are starting to kind of take over Facebook, I think it's going to be really hard for an audience to kind of have a connection or to build trust with one of those kind of newer players that don't necessarily stand for anything.
I think it was a really interesting over the last sort of 3 to 4 years, and you've got this sort of mushrooming of these companies and this content that, and social media is a flood with this content. And initially we kind of saw this as a threat, and then all of a sudden you kind of realize how valuable your brand becomes then. And if you stick to your guns and you do good quality independent journalism and people know that that's what you do and you have rules and structures in place, that's you know, all that you do, your brand becomes distinct from that sort of wash of rubbish.
It sort of floats to
the top. And so people become increasingly loyal to your brand. And we're experiencing that now with people increasingly downloading our app or becoming premium subscribers or now becoming members. So they contribute to the organization. And I think that's almost like a reaction, a reader reaction to this sort of myriad of substandard journalism or content or whatever. It's great for us, really, because we can prove our difference.
Draw on that. Yeah. Well, Raquel, how do you, as a newer outlet, and you're not drawing on decades of credibility as a masthead, how do you build that trust?
So we don't publish content ourselves. Everything that we create, we deliver to publishers or brands who then publish the content. We work in a very robust way with both brands and our native partners. And what's really interesting is that having started out in the traditional editorial space, and we still run a concurrent model, so we still pitch editorial stories to publishers as well that our journalists unearth and pitch via our platform for consideration for editors around the country and around the world. And it's interesting that as you were talking about, the briefing process has become so refined and so robust, and the timing around the deliverables is so much longer that we actually spend a lot more time traditionally on branded content in turning that material around than we often would with the deadlines that we're delivering editorial stories. And there's a very, there's a lot of layers of procurement with sponsored content as well, as we would all know. It can take months, sometimes, unfortunately, for a simple article to go through that process and actually be published. Whether that's a good thing or not, by the time that goes through that washing machine of procurement through legal and all the other departments, that piece of editorial may have shifted slightly. But from a trust perspective, to answer your point, all of our journalists deliver the same style of content for our branded clients as they would for the editorial clients. And when they pitch for stories, sometimes they don't know if they're pitching for a brand or for an editorial client when we distribute a brief. So the mechanism that we use doesn't change.
That's interesting. So there's no sort of... When it comes to writing for a brand, there's no client approval around, going back and forth on a draft.
No, that's that procurement process once the journalist is engaged. But in our platform, we can distribute briefs daily to journalists that might come from editorial clients that we have or from brands. And they all go out unbranded, if you know what I mean. We don't say this is for a brand or this is for a publisher that's looking for a traditional story. They might just both be looking for a case study around a family who has a particular set of circumstances. And the journalist will pitch the story in the same way, regardless of whether the ultimate client is a brand or an editorial client of ours.
I think that's really interesting. And I think that's where the risk is involved, is if you have journalists who are increasingly reliant on their livelihood on writing for brands, is that journalist then still capable of holding that brand to account because it pays their salary? And so I think that when you have an organisation or an industry where journalists are both writing for brands and about brands, or for companies and about companies, I think I think there's a problem there. And that's why our editorial teams do not write branded content. They're focused on, and
I agree. And that's why so many publishers who have made that distinction come to third-party suppliers like us who have a network of journalists who do both, who straddle that fence. And
How does a freelancer navigate something like that?
It was a really interesting period for us when we went from historically exclusively only delivering content stories for editorial clients to then educating our pool of journalists that we're now working with brands. Mm. And of course, we would never hold any journalist accountable to those who wanted to walk away. Mm. And there were a number of journalists, to your point, that refused to work with brands. But one of the questions that was in the synopsis of this particular event was, is native advertising a mechanism to support the journalism industry? And I think that that's quite a naive and backward way of thinking. I mean, native advertising is here to support, make no mistakes, the growth of the publishers. And it is giving journalists work. We have journalists on our platform that we work with regularly who are commissioned to write 30 articles in a month or two. You know, it's consistent. It's, it's good work for them. Mm. So they make that choice because it's a choice that many of them, unfortunately, haven't had the opportunity to potentially not make.
And they're happy to put their byline to it? Is there anyone, are there any people who say, oh, can I be a ghostwriter on this one?
Or, we don't have that come up very often. Mm. And a lot of our brands are now leveraging off the reach of our journalists. Mm. So the clients that we work with will actually start to understand which journalists we are proposing for particular pieces of editorial style content that we're going to create for them. And then we'll even work in a mechanism for that journalist to, once the material has gone live, to actually amplify that through their own social channels or through their LinkedIn page. And as I said earlier, if the article or whatever the piece of content is of a high quality nature, then everyone involved should be proud of that piece of content, including the journalist, especially the journalist.
Mm. Tim, what about from a resources perspective? You talk about the fact that you prefer the whole team to get on board with some things.
Yeah.
How practical is that, and how can you get into a situation where you have journos who are working away on a story that they want to get up and they get pulled off it to work on branded content? How do you navigate that?
Yeah, I'll preface this with kind of how important native advertising has been for us, just because... just almost finish off that point there. It makes up almost 2/3 of our media revenue now. Mm. So as a small and growing publisher, we would not exist if it wasn't for the rise of native advertising. So the way that we look at it is like the work that we do with brands like Qantas and Westpac help us pay the bills so that we can then employ a team of content creators, journalists, video producers to create content and kind of like help essentially fund the journalism that we want to do. Mm. So we almost see it, there's a bit of like a give take. In terms of the resourcing, we generally share it around. So we have a big team of freelancers that we use. And the way our resourcing model works is also because the economics are quite different for the native content work that we do than the pure journalism work that we do. So we pay our writers more for native content than we do for the other piece of writing that we do because we can afford to. Mm. So we get more money in through that way. We therefore give the writer more. And, you know, the digital model is a very hard model for a journalist or a writer to survive off. So there is a two kind of like different economic models work. And I think what any modern publisher is doing is kind of balancing those two things. And it's constantly changing. Mm. So, you know, we've been doing this for a couple of years now, figuring out where those lines are, what you can push back with on a brand. And one thing that we have been really heartened by is that the majority of our writers really seem to relish when we give them native advertising work or branded content work. One, as I said, we pay a little bit more. Mm. But two, it's because we can generally tend to do pieces of content that we wouldn't be able to either afford to do or wouldn't think about doing otherwise. So you might get someone who, you know, is always writing about a certain topic and you say, hey, can you go away and think about this, come up with this great idea that does X or Y? And then we end up creating these really interesting content pieces that wouldn't have been possible if it wasn't for brand X's money.
We talked a little bit earlier in the green room about the fact that really this is no different to traditional modes of advertorial, the idea of advertorial, but we have referenced the fact today that technology means that this is changing so quickly that the lines can get blurry and you need to be able to keep up. How is it a matter of sort of checking in every 6 months to check in on the landscape and recalibrate accordingly?
Every 6 months? Yeah.
Every six hours.
Sorry.
Every week Silicon Valley does something to disrupt my nice, neat business.
It's exhausting.
Yes.
But really, like, how do you, I mean, does someone, who wants to weigh in there?
Yeah, I'll do.
How
it is constantly changing. And yeah, we used to have these things. We used to have, when native kind of first hit the market of 3 or 4 years ago, we had like a 15-point process or something. Mm. And I cannot tell you how many times we've kind of changed and refined that process. The biggest change that we have seen in the whole native advertising space for us has been the shift from native content that's written to video native. That seems to be where all the brands are going at the moment. It's where Facebook is going. It's where publishers are going on Facebook if they want to increase reach and all those kind of algorithmic things. So the brand money is going there at the moment. So interestingly, that is a whole new space because it comes with whole different areas of, it is harder to have, you know, what do you do with signposting is kind of quite different and the work that you do and what works for an audience. So that is, I would say, the area over the past 6 to 12 months that has changed, is changing native advertising again.
I think that's right. I mean, there's lots of different ways of telling stories through data journalism, data visualization, video, interactives, etc. It just changes. It keeps on evolving at such a rapid pace that we're continuously working out how does a brand partnership work using this format, and how do we distinguish it from editorial? And then not only is it the format of the content, it's actually the distribution platform as well. So whether it's Apple News or accelerated mobile pages via Google or instant articles, each have their own nuances, and we have to then, but I think it goes back to understanding what your core purpose is, what your values are, and how you differentiate and communicate to your reader. And once you're absolutely rock solid on those things, you can then just interpret every new format and platform as and when
it
comes.
It's like a filter.
Yeah, it's like, and I think that companies without purpose find that very difficult because they're continuously reinventing what they're doing and they're continuously just chasing what makes money. And I think that most of them will lose their way. They forget who they are and what they've set out to do. And that I think that's the risk.
Is there a limit to what, to who you work with? So there was a interesting example from a few years ago of The Atlantic doing some branded work for the Church of Scientology, which they were absolutely howled down for and took a big hit and eventually published a mea culpa and said, we made a mistake, we shouldn't have done that. And Alan, there was a lot of discussion in June about the Fairfax lift out called China Watch, which was prepared by China Daily, and Media Watch did a big story on it and said they characterised it as Fairfax Media agreeing to take money from the Chinese for spreading their propaganda. Is that a fair characterisation, and did your credibility take a hit from that?
It's interesting. I mean, they came to us as a commercial printing job. That's what it was. They came to us and said, would you commercially print this? So it doesn't have any involvement in the newsroom. However, we sat down with them and spoke about it and said, well, you know, some of the editors in chief would like to look at this material and see, you know, from an audience perspective, the relevancy of it. We were very clear about labelling with them. And in actual fact, there's been a couple of instances where they've done some one-off pieces with us where we've actually enforced even stronger labelling on it, even to the point of saying it's an advertisement, label it. That's the way it is. And they've been very flexible about that in what you do. But they're looking at how do they use our audience. And, you know, it's a bit like native advertising. They're looking at our audience and saying, OK, you've got an audience that's influential, you've got strong brands, and they've aligned with us.
I was just going to add that I think it's in all of our best interests, the journalism industry, the media industry, and us as suppliers and publishers, for the quality of the content to remain at the highest standard. And I think I was at the Content Marketing World conference in Cleveland in September, and this was something that was constantly being raised over there. There are a lot of third-party native plug-in platforms that you know, we would find on most of the major publishers' sites that when they launched and continue to go to market with a set of rules for engagement around the quality of the content that they expect, and we certainly, when we supply native content that we know is going to be delivered through those vehicles, adhere to pretty strict editorial guidelines. But I think we are seeing more and more of this sort of clickbaity material at the bottom of pages, bikini pics and, you know, all sorts of stuff that is like totally out of place with the rest of the editorial content on those sites, and I think that that probably is reaching a point where it's going to bottom out, and there will need to be, in my view, a refresh of the quality of that native content that's being pushed through those providers.
I know The Guardian pride itself on turning down money, so
give us details of anyone you've ever said no to?
I won't mention brands, but I mean, editorial have veto on any brand we work with. If they say no, we don't do it.
So you put every brand to them?
Not every brand, but where there's potential conflict. So, for instance, we had, the Mineral Councils of Australia, which was we were criticised for not taking money from them, but we just thought it'd be hypocritical, given that we'd run a Keep It in the Ground campaign over the last year, then to take money from the fossil fuel industry. So we don't want to be hypocritical. That's part of our charter, is being honest and having integrity. We had a very big fizzy drink brand with not a very good environmental record who wanted to support some stuff we wanted to do around the Great Barrier Reef. Again, you know, we don't want to be an agent for greenwashing of any company that, you know. So it's just sticking to our values. And if it contradicts any of our fundamental values, then we don't do it.
What about a brand like Unilever? Unilever are quite controversial in parts.
Yeah, but we worked with Unilever about the Live Better Challenge. There was a long process in consultation between commercial and editorial about whether that was something we would do. We decided that we would, as an organisation, we felt that they were trying to be better and they were attempting to be a more sustainable business. We did a long paid for campaign called the Live Better Challenge, which is basically encouraging people to make small changes to their life to be more sustainable. And then it gave Unilever an opportunity in those environments to talk about the steps that their company were making to be more sustainable. But the great thing is we can do that and we can take their money and we think, well, okay, we'll give them an opportunity to say that. But at the same time, our editorial are absolutely free to criticise them for all the points where they're not doing that quickly enough or they've made errors or whatever. So,
and that's where that point about promises that Alan made, what kind of promises are you making to clients? Is that built into your agreement, the freedom and the right to be able to report anything and everything on them?
That's the first thing I say to media agencies and brands that we work with. I explain our corporate structure, the Scott Trust, and that we have absolutely no power over editorial. There was a fairly famous internally scenario. When I first joined, there was a large bank in the UK that were just about to spend multi-million pound brand partnership and advertising campaign on The Guardian. And the day before they signed the agreement, The Guardian exposed the LIBOR price-fixing scandal. So the interbank exchange rate, there was a price-fixing going on. We exposed it front page. And, of course, you know, the commercial director got a call from the advertising agency saying, "What are you doing? We're just about to sign this. Can you get that off your front page?" And the answer was no. And you probably need to up your marketing spend now because your reputation is in the mud, you know.
What about you, Tim? Have you ever said no to anyone?
Yeah, proudly. we're quite lucky that we're a small publisher, so we can kind of make the decision, you know, in the room, get three people together and make a decision. Mm. We have said no to oil companies wanting to do native advertising, talking about how green and amazing they are, which didn't sit well with us or with our audience. Mm. And I think every publisher kind of weighs those things up. I think even Crikey, your alumni, who have kind of been critical or questioning of native advertising. Mm. They ran a sports bet native advertising campaign a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm not there anymore.
You're not there anymore. But I just thought that was interesting.
Kind of downhill,
it shows that everyone is having these discussions and even places like Crikey.
Yeah, being a small organisation in some ways is easier because you can have the discussion, but it's also very tempting because you need the money.
Very much so. It's very hard to say no to money, but you have to have a line, and your line is where editorial, sales, management and the audience don't want to go. And we also build in what we call a kill switch into every piece of native advertising, which is at any time either us or the brand can kill the content. So all the way, right the way up to before you press publish, if you don't feel comfortable with it, if you think it's crap, if the brand doesn't feel comfortable with it, and both sides of that have exercised the kill switch many times over the... We've published, I think it was like 600 or 700 pieces of native content over the past couple of years, and we've used that kill switch many times.
I think we employ the same values commercially as well. So we've had brands where we've got no moral objection to the brand, but it's just the wrong audience. I mean, we know our audience is not going to be introduced in that fast food product. I mean, it's just not, it's the wrong audience. Yeah. And so we pride ourselves on saying you should advertise with someone else. Mm. You know, and you should advertise with Junkie.
And it will detract from your
brand. We'll take it, thanks.
I think I'm going to have to stop hogging you and throw to the audience. But I'll just throw one more question at you. Are there types of content for which this kind of thing is cozier or easier or rather than straight news reporting, say food, for example, and lifestyle, you know, are people more comfortable with this kind of thing? Are newsrooms more comfortable with this kind of thing if it's shunted into those areas? And is that a healthy attitude?
I was just going to give one quick example of a great piece of branded content and a space where I believe it works really well, and that's in the education sector, where education providers like Melbourne University, who I believe actually published a piece recently on some research that was taking place around the 12 apostles. And that piece was then picked up largely by traditional publishers the following day or later that day and referenced back to the original publisher. So it does provide in some spaces, some verticals, an opportunity for brands and organisations to lead that conversation. And I think that that's a really important mechanism as well, because it gives those publishers, those brands, the space to actually bring light to some important conversations like research that was taking place in that instance.
Yeah, from a traditional sense, yes. I mean, we've separated out, you know, our food people, you know, the travel people, certain categories where we can see there's a different competitive tension for audience. And they still have a strong connection into the existing newsroom because the values still need to be there. Mm. But it's given them the opportunity to actually move in a different way. And I'm actually surprised how often they come back and talk to the newsroom, because they actually want to know, you know, are we really connected with what's happening, or have we been taken into this space which is predominantly about, you know, we're self-absorbed about travel or about food, and we lose that connection with the core audience?
I mean, for us, news and politics is just not, it's just a no-go. Having said that, you can fall into a trap of saying, oh, well, you know, food and lifestyle's fine, you know, we can bend the rules there. But I think that's, you have to be extra careful there. So we wouldn't, for example, have Jacob's Creek doing some stuff on wine. Mm. So we try and do lateral connections between the brand and the subject matter. Because, you know, we still pride ourselves of our, you know, our travel writing and our food writing and our tech writing is all still independent. Mm. If it's editorial, it's entirely independent. It's not influenced by any brand at all. So I think actually in more into the sort of softer verticals, the more lifestyle-y verticals, I think that you run a greater risk there because people's, you know, the guard is down.
Okay, I'm going to throw to the audience now. So if you can put your hand up very high and someone will come to you with a mic.
Thank you, Mark Pearson from Griffith University in Queensland. I haven't heard the words law or legal raised in the discussion, and you'd all be aware of the Australian Consumer Law, where Section 18 has provision related to misleading and deceptive conduct in the course of business. Section 19 protects information providers. It's an exemption clause, but not when the sponsorship is promoting the sale of goods or services. So I'm wondering what mechanisms you each have in place to navigate this law, in other words, to be able to justify and prove each and every claim that's made in any of your advertorials.
Who wants to go first?
I'll kick off. So the native advertising that we do generally doesn't talk about the product, doesn't make any claims. And that's, you know, the definition, obviously, where every publisher is different. But when we say inspired by a brand, if we're going to do something with Ford, we're not going to talk about any of the features of the Ford car. We're going to talk about how it makes you feel or what it makes you do. I'll give you like a perfect live example is a campaign we're doing at the moment with Toyota Yaris, which is kind of targeted millennials, who's our audience. our whole campaign is called The Drive Within You, and it's all about inspiring young millennials to kind of get out there and show them amazing stories. The only time the car is mentioned is in the ads surrounding it. So we obviously make sure that we really clearly signpost at the top, at the bottom, throughout the piece of content what it is, but we really do not mention anything to do with any of the products or anything like that that might need legal requirements.
I think that's an interesting one. I think we don't do that for strategic reasons, not legal reasons. And so one of the main conversations that we're having with marketing managers or CMOs of a brand who traditionally in their marketing plan have the brand at the center of their marketing plan and then all the television commercial and the social content and everything else around it. And we advise the marketing managers is that if they really want to do content and you really want audiences to be genuinely engaged with this content and your brand, you need to take your brand out of the center of your marketing campaign and put your target audience in the center and think about what it is that they would be interested in. And so, for example, we did some work with GE, but it was all around, it wasn't about any GE product at all. It was about innovation around Australia and these amazing people around Australia that were developing and inventing all these new technologies. And it's and because that's what their target audience would want to read about. And if you started writing long articles about their, you know, turbines or their products, they just wouldn't have got the engagement, wouldn't have got their reach that they required.
Yeah, Mark, in terms of us, a bit of experience. I mean, the Therapeutic Goods Act, publishers all, we ran into that many years ago around the claims of certain products. We were very quick, the legal profession was very quick to point out to us what was there, what was happening. I think we've learned through experience. I think that's why it's still important that you've got people in your organisation who understand what that is from a legal perspective. It's no different to defamation law or anything else in the organisation. And I've had a couple come across my desk where we've said, you know, if the claim's false, don't run it. Absolutely.
Thank you. I'll chip in with only my experience, which was having worked in a newsroom for 10 years and the number of times mistakes were made in that newsroom were countless. And going back to my earlier point around the procurement of the content we deliver for brands in particular, and you speak of the Therapeutic Goods Act and the levels of procurement that that each piece of content, typically written material, goes through, will receive multiple amends and markups and cross-checks, fact checks with their teams. And that really, from a branded perspective, gives us a lot of assurance that we have that time frame, because we're not traditionally working to those same deadlines that I worked to in a newsroom where a lot of those mistakes were being made.
Okay, do we have more hands in the air?
Look, obviously real estate and apartments are a huge area of advertising revenue, and I just wondered if you could all make a comment about native advertising in that area.
Me?
Alan, do you want to...
Well, it's not a specialist area for me. I don't look after domain, so I don't know. Domain operate in a very different world in that regard, with agent listings and things of that nature. So I'm not...
I don't publish native content, so we supply to some brands that work in the real estate space. Most of what we are actually delivering is things like market reports, monthly market reports, and that data is gained in the same fashion that it would have been gained through any other mechanism. So if we're doing other content, it's generally very broad around, you know, ways to spruce up your apartment for the best sale, how to dress for an auction, all the really important things.
Yeah, I don't think that we've actually ever done it in that space. The only ones that kind of spring to mind are similar ones to Raquel was mentioning. They're kind of like the softer sides of home furnishings and stuff like that, as opposed to anything in real estate.
And the Guardian haven't weighed in there.
We've done some stuff. We've done some paid for stuff by a property developer, but it was paid for articles about their sort of the architectural designs of their particular project in Western Australia. That's the only thing that comes to mind. We are asked by large groups if we could set up a property section. That is a common question. Can you do more about property?
Right, because that's where the money is. Yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of advertising money there. So I don't know. I have to speak to Lenore about it.
Something to think about. Yeah. Okay, who's next? There's one down the front here.
Hello, my name's Julia Scott. I work at Swinburne University, and I was interested in your comment about education brands, because what I was wondering is what your insights are in terms of how brands can best work to get media, given the blurring line between paid and earned media. And I certainly notice inside the industry the need from a brand's perspective to align much more closely. So what's that mean for us in terms of how we should be working and how we should be both pitching and also doing deals with you as publishers or as content makers?
We've got a lot of experience because our audience is 18 to 35-year-olds, which is kind of, smack bang in the middle of most university kind of marketing. The best thing that universities have is their alumni. There are so many amazing stories that each kind of university has. So we work really closely. I'll give you an example with ANU at the moment. And we host an event in Canberra called Junket, where we kind of take 200 bright young Australians, lock them in QT Hotel for a couple of days and get them to try and figure out where Australia's future is going to go over the next couple of years. Not a small task, but ANU is heavily involved in that. So in terms of getting their alumni there, doing speeches, helping to kind of tell the stories of the people that go there, why they go there and how their experience has been afterwards. So I think that is kind of like hooking into using every single alumni that you have and figuring out which of those are most relevant to an organisation. Some of them perfect for Junkie, some would be perfect for The Guardian, some would be perfect for The Age, and using them to your advantage. Because that, as Ian was saying, when you put the consumer in at the centre, if you put the consumer in the centre there, the consumer always wants to see stories of aspirational people who have done amazing things.
I could only add to that that my experience has been that the age of pitching a story to the media is diminishing, and the age of owning your story, publishing it, and owning that conversation, as I mentioned earlier, is really what's taking on. And from our perspective, it's about unearthing those stories. So we're working on a project with Victorian Government to unearth hundreds of stories across Victoria around innovation and investment. And a lot of them are working with what we call fire starters within the education sector. And it's really, the first step is unearthing those stories and having the people involved in that research or those projects actually come forward to talk about what they're actually doing. And we've then worked directly with universities, and we can talk about this in more detail. In fact, I'm meeting with Swinburne next week. but how we've actually brought those stories to light and then engage third-party partners to promote that content essentially and draw an audience to that content through the likes of these publishers, third-party providers.
Yeah, I do think it's the what is the story. Fairfax, through its digital ventures group, has an investment in an education business in generating content, and we talk to them on a regular basis. And I actually find in some cases our community and our regional newspapers, because they're closer to what's happening in the school system, as against the metropolitan hub, where there's a lot of schools in that model, where they're closer, they actually get a lot more traction. I actually found when I was in New Zealand, the fact that we were closely involved with the education department there, looking at Decile 1 and Decile 2 schools and actually putting literature, which we used to give away about, my time there, I think we got up to giving away over 100,000 books. It wasn't giving away the books that was the issue. It was getting into the schools with the literacy programs and actually engaging with that. Out of that came some magnificent stories.
A huge category for us, sort of internationally, universities are competing for international students, and we have 150 million unique browsers around the world. A lot of those are potential students. So we advertise a lot. Monash do a lot of advertising. University of Melbourne do a lot of advertising. We have done some brand campaigns for University of Melbourne, talking about this sort of collision of minds and what a great space it is for energy and ideas and stuff. And that's just building the sort of profile of the university, not just for students, but also to encourage research donations and philanthropy and stuff like that. So they're yeah, great category for us. We're also, there's been lots of interesting conversations about sort of unleashing all of the talent and brilliance inside universities, and how can we get some of those brilliant people who know about these, especially at the moment when there's so much happening in scientific research and humanities and lots of different areas. It just, and really that brilliance is contained inside the university a lot of the time. And as a publisher, as an international publisher, we can help bring out those voices, onto our platform.
And I would also just say that you can also think about leveraging the audience that might exist through the partners that you're working with. So Victorian government, as an example, they want to tell those stories. So by connecting and partnering with partners like that, you can actually have that piece of content distributed to their audience as well. And that could be more targeted, more beneficial than the traditional audiences that you might have been seeking through pitching stories to the media.
A friend's son, who's just completed his IB, was telling me that they, at Redlands, I think it was, and in North Shore of Sydney, and he was saying that they used The Guardian as a standard text for the critical thinking component of their course. So I was just wondering if I should be charging them for that.
Definitely.
New revenue
We've
model.
Got time to squeeze in one last quick question, if there is one. I don't know that there is. Yep, one. Oh, Mark, you're hogging the limelight. You can do that. Oh, no, there's someone else.
it's slightly like being interviewed by the Stasi with these lights and sort of questions being fired at you.
I can't see a thing.
Just a quick question. Interested in your view on the, if you like, pushback to native in the form of ad blockers. So, you know, you've been very eloquent about the success of native and branded content, but I'm just interested in your observations about pushback.
Yeah, the ad blockalypse, as it's called, is something that has starting to happen overseas. We did some research recently on our audience, which, as I mentioned, is millennials, and 58% of them said they use an ad blocker in some way. Now, that's probably across multiple devices. I think if you have three or four devices, we on our titles see it about 10 to 15% of people kind of blocking ads. Now, what that is a rejection of kind of traditional banner advertising, the traditional ways that brands are trying to reach audiences. The reason that native advertising has risen so much is because it gets around ad blockers. So it is interesting that it has kind of like risen almost to subvert what is kind of like a user behaviour. But I think, as I mentioned before, the fact that the reader has ultimate control in this is that what is kind of stopping bad native content and good native content is down to someone's choice. So in the past, where you didn't have a choice whether you saw ads or not, now you have that choice. And now you don't have a choice whether you see native content or not, but you do have a choice on whether you actually click on it and read in it and engage with it.
Yeah, interesting for us as a mainstream publisher that we've actually been working with Google around an education program for our readership around what ad blocking does and what's the cause and effect of ad blocking and what's the cause and effect on our business model. Because you know, the advertising's not there, the model's going to change dramatically, and we're then competing. So one hand we're competing with them, and the other half they've come to us and said, well, we want to help you educate your audience. And there's some naivety about ad blocking purely even just at the basic technology level around, you know, what's in browsers, what's turned on, what's not turned on. Some people don't even know that it's turned on. In that regard, you know, the scary thing about it is that there's plenty of people in the world that are creating new web browsers, and they're 100% all about blocking ads. I had some experience that last year in the Middle East where I came across a couple, and you know, they're a very different model. They're about, you know, get people to pay for it, a lot of volume. So you know, for us, it's a real challenge around that. I'd have to say the other side, we do use ad blocking ourselves. There's a lot of our competitors that I'd like to use our network. And, you know, we've blocked them from using our network predominantly to protect our own position.
Ad blocking is a threat. It's not turned out to be as big as we thought. There's about 13% of our ads are blocked. There's a couple, so native advertising and the brand partnerships are one of the ways we get around that. So we can take advertising money in that way, and that content isn't blocked by ads. We also have reduced the amount of ads and improved the quality, so they're just so people don't mind them so much. So on The Guardian, we have I think it's an average of 2.5 ads per page, and most of our competitors have between 5 and 10 ads per page. But we just think that's better for the user and actually more effective for the brand's advertising. And then also we've been messaging people who we see are using an ad blocker and sort of explaining to them that because we remain free, that's one of the ways we pay for our independent journalism. And if they don't like ads, would they mind taking up a premium subscription or becoming a member and paying that way?
Does that work?
We tried a polite one and that didn't work so well. And then we tried a slightly narkier one and that did work. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. And you can play on readers' guilt as well.
Yeah.
Google have done some really terrific research into that about how hard you can actually push with the messaging.
Fascinating.
I mean, some media companies are just, it's like you don't have access to this content anymore. And it may be if it got bad, you'd have to do that. You know, the other thing was a lot of these ad blocking technology companies have started charging media owners to be whitelisted on their platform.
Yes. Oh,
it's
wow.
Like a protection racket, isn't it? Basically, it's like, you know, pay us and we won't smash your windows. Yeah. It's kind of the same thing.
They got a lot of kickback for that. I think they then kind of dropped it a couple of days later. But that is crazy to say we're going to block the ads. But actually, no, we'll pay for them if you give us enough money. Yeah.
The Wild West out there. Well, think before you ad block, folks. On that note, we'll have to wind it up. We're out of time. So please join me in thanking Tim, Raquel, Alan and Tim.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.